The latest economic expansion has created staggering wealth, but not for everyone.
That's made people who are pretty well off much more well off, and it's caused a sort of divergence between, say, the top 1% of households and everybody else.
And the Trump administration is close to expanding overtime pay.
It means that a lot of people will probably become eligible for overtime.
Plus, a proposed opioid deal with Purdue Pharma has drawn pushback. This is What's News from The Wall Street Journal. I'm Kim Gittleson. Let's get started. Now, before we take a look at why the decade-long economic expansion has passed by many American families, hint it has to do with assets, here's what you missed. A proposed deal for Purdue Pharma to resolve more than 2,000 lawsuits over its role in the opioid crisis is facing pushback. A group of state attorneys general, including Massachusetts and New York, say it doesn't bring in enough cash to satisfy their demands. That's according to people familiar with the matter. We reported that the proposed settlement would value Purdue at up to $12 billion. A Purdue spokeswoman declined to comment. And the Trump administration is moving to expand the number of Americans eligible for overtime pay. The rule could come as early as next month. Andrew Ackerman explains what will change.
They're looking at raising a key salary threshold to around $36,000 annually. And what that basically means is that if you work more than 40 hours a week, and you make less than around $36,000 a year, you will automatically be eligible for overtime for time and a half pay.
Andrew says the rule is targeting a specific type of worker, managers.
It's designed to ensure that managers and other salaried employees basically make overtime, even if they just don't make a ton of money. Many businesses pay overtime to hourly workers, but often exempt managers and other salaried employees from additional pay. So this threshold is intended to protect workers who may have a manager title, but relatively low earnings. Under the current threshold, it's about 400 something a week. It'll rise to roughly 700, we believe.
According to people familiar with the matter, the details could still change as the administration works to finish the rule. And police in Hong Kong arrested three prominent opposition activists, including Joshua Wong, this morning. The move comes a day after police denied approval for a massive rally planned for Saturday. We report the move could give new energy to the pro-democracy protest movement. Now, our main story this morning. The latest economic expansion has created staggering wealth driven by the stock market and rising home prices. But many Americans have not shared in the wealth creation. Here's a stat for you. The bottom half of all U.S. households, as measured by wealth, have 32% less wealth than in 2003. But the top 1% of households have more than twice as much as they did back then. Charlie Turner has been finding out why this happened from David Harrison.
David, you write that the decade-long economic expansion has created staggering new wealth, but most Americans have not shared in this wealth. Explain that.
Yeah, so since the recession ended, we've had this really big, long boom in the stock market, a big, long bull market, and that's made a lot of people very rich, people who are invested in the stock market, and those tend to be people who are generally pretty well off. And so essentially, that's made people who are pretty well off much wealthier, and it's caused this sort of divergence between, say, the top 1%, the top 10% of households and everybody else.
And the wealthiest 1% own a vast majority of assets like equities.
They do. So really, their net worth kind of rises and falls based on the performance of things like the stock market. And so since it's been doing so well for so long, their net worth has gone up quite a bit. Now, for the bottom 50%, you know, for sort of the bottom half of the country, most of their wealth, slightly over 50%, just is in the form of housing. And that's been much slower to recover.
What exactly is defined by wealth, David? It's different from income.
Yeah, that's right. Wealth, you know, same as net worth. It's basically, you know, all your assets, so your house and the bank, any kind of stock portfolio, your 401k, all that minus all the debt you owe. So if you have a house, you know, you take the value of your house minus your mortgage. That's sort of that's counted as your housing wealth. And then you subtract all other kinds of debt, like student loans, car loans, credit card bills, that whole thing. And that ends up with your net worth. So it's pretty much like a big pot of assets that you have. Income is different because that's sort of the money, the stock, you know, I mean, the flow of income that you get on a regular basis from your job, from government benefits, from dividends, that kind of thing.
All right, the trend is being driven by the fact that the wealthiest demographic owns so much stock, while many lower-income people derive their equity from their home. Hasn't wealth inequality also been driven by the fact that it's harder to buy a home these days than it was before the financial crisis?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. One thing that really drove up the net worth of the bottom 50% before the crisis was housing. Housing wealth rose rapidly, but of course so did mortgages. After the crisis, for a number of reasons, there's some new rules put in place by the government. So it's become a lot harder for people, say, with a less than perfect credit history, people who don't have, say, a big down payment to buy a house. So that's kind of frozen out a number of people from the housing market. And so as housing has recovered, those people who haven't been able to afford a house basically haven't shared in the appreciation.
Isn't wealth especially important because it helps households weather the ups and downs of the economy?
Yeah, that's right. This is sort of the overall reason kind of why it's important to look at this. And that is that as long as the economy is going well, as it is, right now, more or less, and as long as people have jobs, and as long as, say, incomes are rising, everything's fine. Like, you get your income, you can survive, you can pay the bills, that's all fine. Where wealth becomes really important is in periods when there's a downturn, when there's a recession, and say you lose your job, or you say you're out of work for like 6 months. If you have money saved up, some assets saved up, you can use that to pay the bills until you get a new job. If you don't, then you're in trouble. And so the concern is that there is this big segment of the American population that hasn't built up its wealth during this very, very long expansion. It's the longest expansion on record. And, if a big chunk of the population hasn't taken advantage or hasn't been able to take advantage of this long sort of rosy period to build up its net worth, that puts them in a very precarious position when the next recession hits.
You can find David's story up on WSJ.com. On to markets. U.S. stocks rallied yesterday on renewed hopes for progress in U.S.-China trade relations. All three main indices closed up over 1%. Caitlin Ostroff has more on what investors were paying attention to.
So investors were looking at comments from China's Commerce Ministry indicating that Beijing and Washington are still in talks about the U.S.-China trade tensions and some of the tariffs that are scheduled to go into effect this weekend. And there was also some indication that China didn't want to impose further retaliatory tariffs or at least escalate things further. And so the markets, being somewhat desperate for any signs of good news in this very tense atmosphere, sent stocks higher on the hopes that there will be a resolution to some of these trade tensions and tariffs will go away.
And now the SCED. Here's what else we're paying attention to today. Hurricane Dorian has strengthened into a Category 2 hurricane. The National Hurricane Center's Ken Graham says it could strengthen even further.
We are forecasting the potential of a Category 4 storm, 130 miles an hour, by the time we make landfall in Florida.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declared a state of emergency for all of Florida's 67 counties. He said, quote, "The time to act is now." And we've got an exclusive investigation today about Facebook's efforts to combat the spread of misinformation. It has to do with Brazil's presidential elections last year. Ahead of those elections, Facebook's executives publicly touted their efforts as evidence that the company was making progress in combating the spread of misinformation. However, today we report that inside Facebook, the picture was more complicated. Deepa Seetharaman explains.
What this is an internal review. A specific incident in the run-up to the election, a woman politician in Rio, her name is Mariel Franco, she was assassinated on her way back from a rally. And almost immediately, rumors started spreading all over Facebook and WhatsApp, as well as other social media platforms about her and her death. And these rumors really started taking root on social media. And they were flagged to Facebook a couple of days later by reporters, forcing the company to do an internal review of what exactly had happened.
Deepa got a copy of that internal review, and here's what Facebook's internal investigators found.
In its analysis of this particular event, Facebook drills down to maybe five different problems. And, it diagnoses two fundamental issues. One, they couldn't proactively find this misinformation without it being flagged first by an outside party. And, there's a line in the report that says, I'll read it. We have not had the resources to develop tools and processes for proactive detection of violating apps. And at another point, it says, our coordinated, inauthentic behavior policy is not proactively enforced at scale. So it comes down to, at least part of the problem is Facebook didn't have the mechanisms in place to find this behavior before it became a problem.
Facebook officials described the Brazil review as an early internal appraisal of its push to squelch misinformation. Nathaniel Gleicher, Facebook's head of cybersecurity policy, said the company's defenses have strengthened considerably since the report was written in August 2018. He told us in an interview that he thought Facebook was in a, quote, better place today to identify and disrupt this stuff than we've ever been. Deepa's full report with Jeff Horowitz is up on our website. Finally, good news if you met your partner on Match.com, Tinder, or Bumble, or Coffee Meets Bagel, or Hinge. There is now evidence that online dating could, in fact, be improving the likelihood of romantic compatibility and making marriages stronger. Researchers from the University of Chicago found that more than a third of U.S. marriages between 2005 and 2012 started online, and that online couples have longer, happier marriages. The researchers suggested that a greater pool of potential spouses might give users more options and allow them to be more selective. That's what's news from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.